Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
At the current rate of exchange, one Bitcoin will get you about $540 or nothing at all. Bitcoin in the balance, coming up from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Tuesday, the 25th of February. Great to have you with us, everybody. Bitcoin is where we start today. The newfangled, slightly impenetrable, somewhat risky, and quite volatile cybercurrency that's been all the rage in foreign exchange markets the past, 6 months or so, I guess. The news, of course, is that Mt. Gox, the biggest and oldest of the Bitcoin trading exchanges, has been taken offline, vanished, essentially, without a forwarding address, and taking something like $350 million in Bitcoins with it. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and he is also the guy we call when we have Bitcoin questions. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
Without putting too fine a point on it, man, what the heck?
Yeah, it's been a bad year for Bitcoin and a terrible month for Mt. Gox. This is the largest exchange historically for Bitcoin. They've been having major problems recently. There was a hack earlier this month, a security problem that people were really up in arms about. And of course, over the last day, the website basically went dark. And now there's just a message on the website saying, we've decided to close all transactions for the time being in order to protect the site and our users.
Do you believe that for the time being part, or are they done, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, think of walking up to a Bank of America and seeing a sign that said closed until further notice.
Except when Bank of America closes, it's not like they actually take 6% of all the money in the United States out of circulation, which is the amount of Bitcoin that's gone now.
Yes. Well, there's this news that's circulating. 750,000 Bitcoin, 6%, as you say. You know, I think some stuff has to shake out, obviously. And the difference here, as you're pointing out, Bitcoin, it's not FDIC insured. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Is this then, do you think, the death of Bitcoin, or is it for the risk favoring among us a buying opportunity?
Well, maybe it's a gambling opportunity. Yeah. It's not the death of Bitcoin in my mind. Look, proponents would say this is part of growing pains. There are other exchanges. There's one in the U.S. called Coinbase, for instance. Yeah. These exchanges have been treated, I think, by some of the investors as a little bit more stable. So I think a lot of people who believe in Bitcoin would say, look, this is just growing pains. This is part of an unregulated currency, you know, coming into its own. But the detractors would say this is bad news. So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Since you mentioned that word currency, right, this is in some respects a currency story, a foreign exchange story, and a tech story, right? This whiz-bang new thing that's out there.
Yeah, it starts out as a tech story. Bitcoin is based on this sort of complicated code that you probably wouldn't fully understand as an average Joe until you knew something about coding. But it really wants to be a currency story. The people who are proponents of Bitcoin want it to be a legitimate currency that a lot of people use. And so they're hoping that someday maybe it will be a currency story, but we're going to have to wait for regulation.
Well, speaking of which, if regulators could figure this thing out, which by all accounts they have yet to be able to, what would regulation of this market look like? I mean, it's anonymous, it's cyber-based, it's all this stuff.
I think we might see a future where people deal in digital currency, not necessarily Bitcoin, by the way, but digital currency that is actually protected by your bank. But that's going to make some people unhappy who have loved Bitcoin for the reason that it's not connected to the government or to the banks.
And also people just have to believe this stuff is worth something, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
you don't think so?
No, absolutely. But there's no difference there between that and, you know, that green stuff you and I are carrying around in our wallets, right?
Yeah, except I can touch and feel and spend it like in actual person, you know, as opposed to having to dial up my computer.
That is true, and that's a fundamental difference.
Ben Johnson, he's the host of Marketplace Tech. Ben, thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, Guy.
In case you're wondering, the price of a single Bitcoin is up about 1,600% in the past year. On Wall Street today, far more modest returns. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Great Polar Vortex will descend once again on the Midwest and the Northeast later this week. Also descending on residents is last month's heating bill. And for a whole lot of people, it's not going to be pretty, like more than $400 not pretty. There is, of course, the obvious reason, burning more to stay warm. But there's another reason as well. Gas prices jumped a whole lot just as the mercury was falling. Which brings to mind faint memories of the U.S. natural gas boom and the promise of abundant and cheap domestic energy. Marketplace's David Weinberg has that story.
The natural gas industry has delivered on its promise of abundant domestic energy. So logic would follow that high supply means low prices. And for the most part, that's true. The national price of natural gas didn't change much during the recent cold snap. Severin Borenstein is co-director of the Energy Institute at the Haas School of Business at Berkeley.
Well, we saw national prices in the $5 or $6 range per million BTU. We've seen prices in the Northeast as high as $100.
The reason for that crazy 2,000% jump in price is that even though we have lots of natural gas, we don't have the infrastructure to move it quickly enough when demand spikes.
Because the pipeline capacity to get it into the Northeast isn't that large. Likewise, that can happen in the Midwest.
But even with improved pipeline capacity, natural gas prices are still susceptible to price spikes, says Michael Levy, a senior fellow for energy and the environment at the Council on Foreign Relations.
The reality is natural gas is expensive to store.
And when you can't store large quantities of fuel, it's difficult to smooth out prices over a long period of time.
Let me flag one other thing that's very important here.
Levy says that over the last few months, we have seen huge regional spikes in gas prices. And the national price of gas is also up by two-thirds over last year.
But the level we've reached is still lower than what we would have had without this natural gas boom. It's still far lower than what people pay in Europe. It's extraordinarily low compared to what people are paying in Asia. And it should moderate in the coming months.
I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
That reputation that government bureaucrats have for being, you know, bureaucratic, risk-averse, and inflexible. Well, don't nobody tell them about the great state of Connecticut. Connecticut's new healthcare exchange has been so successful that officials there are now setting up a consulting business to help other states do the same thing. Exchange in a box is what it's called. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Apparently, word got around that Connecticut's online healthcare exchange was going gangbusters because the exchange's CEO, Kevin Counihan, started getting calls from other states wanting his help.
And so as we've had discussions with those states, it came to us that there could be a business model here.
Counihan and his team are thinking like entrepreneurs. They're selling three different kinds of products, you could say. A state can really splurge and buy a premium package where Connecticut handles everything from the technology to sales and marketing to vendor management.
The second model is more stripped down.
States can go a la carte and pick and choose which services they want, or they can go bare bones and just license Connecticut's technology.
Connecticut seems to be looking for revenue. I don't know how much they can earn, but it's an innovative way to generate it.
Alan Weil at the National Academy for State Health Policy, he says it's potentially a smart deal for Connecticut's customers, too. Those may well include states that regret letting the feds run their exchanges. Sabrina Corlett is at Georgetown's Center on Health Insurance Reforms.
And if they can simply tap into or buy the Connecticut technology without having to build their own from scratch, that saves them time and money.
Healthcare consultants say that may hold a lot of appeal in red states where the idea of hiring a lot of government employees isn't politically palatable. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There are so many things in our everyday lives that we just take for granted that seemingly have always been there. Except, of course, they haven't. Somebody invented them. Somebody who could innovate. That's our new series, The Innovators, people who change the way entire industries do business. This week, African Americans who did that, including decades before the Civil War, a black tailor named Thomas Jennings. Dan Bobkoff has that story.
It's not so important what Thomas Jennings invented nearly two centuries ago in Lower Manhattan. In fact, many of the details of his patent were lost in a fire. So this is what we know.
He developed a process for cleaning of clothes, for cleaning out the dirt and debris off of clothes, and it was called scouring at that time.
Pat Sluby is a retired U.S. patent examiner and the author of a book about African-American inventors. She says Thomas Jennings improved dry cleaning and, in the process, made history. Jennings is thought to be the first African-American ever to receive a U.S. patent.
He is the earliest that we have recorded. He is the very earliest in 1821, and this is 44 years before the end of slavery.
This was a time when slavery wasn't even fully abolished in New York State, yet Jennings was undeterred.
He was a very good entrepreneur and a businessman.
Jennings' work caught the attention of Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist hero. Douglass wrote about Jennings after his death. He says that when Jennings became an adult, he started his own tailoring business and saw a market opportunity for a better way to clean clothes. Now, getting a patent wasn't so easy for anyone in the 1800s.
At that time, patenting was seen to be a God-given ability, and people of color, black people, were seen to be genetically inferior.
Rayvon Fouché heads the American Studies program at Purdue University.
So the idea of a black person receiving a patent was completely confusing and unbelievable to most.
Jennings' business and patent brought him success. As he got older and wealthier, he supported the anti-slavery movement, and it rubbed off on one of his children, Elizabeth Jennings Graham. She became an early civil rights icon after she was forcibly removed from a streetcar just because she was black.
Well, we characterize her as the first Rosa Parks.
Calvin Butts is pastor at the legendary Abyssinian Baptist Church, where both Thomas Jennings and Elizabeth were members. Thomas wanted to sue the streetcar company, so he used his connections to find a lawyer who could win Elizabeth's case.
It was amazing that she could bring litigation against a white-owned company and win.
For Thomas Jennings, who's nearly forgotten by history, it's that first patent that is his lasting legacy. Frederick Douglass writes of Jennings in his patent that although it was well known that he was a black man of African descent, these letters recognize him as a citizen of the United States. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I feel it creates a hall of mirrors, meaning all you see is a reflection of yourself.
Shopping in the surveillance state. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrials gave back a 0.1% today. That's 27 points. Closed at 16,179. The NASDAQ forfeited a 0.1%, 5 points. Ended at 4,287. The S&P 500 lost just under a 0.1%. We'll call that 2 points. Finished at 1,845. Home Depot put on nearly 4% today after reporting better earnings than expected and increasing its dividend 21%. Office Depot shares shredded 9% after the chain surprised the market with a fourth quarter loss. JPMorgan Chase fell 1.75% today after saying it's going to cut more jobs than expected this year. That is 15,000 jobs. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.7%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for January. A Senate committee discusses retirement savings for low-income workers. And singer-songwriter Johnny Cash was born on February 26, 1932. The man in black would have been 82. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hot on the heels of Facebook spending $19 billion for WhatsApp, the Chinese internet company Sina wants to get a piece of the tech action.
The company that's based out of Shanghai has plans to raise $500 million in a U.S.-based initial public offering for Weibo, basically the Chinese version of Twitter. It's become one of the world's most popular social networks. But as Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz points out, timing in these kinds of things is everything.
In an internet landscape enclosed by the Great Firewall, Sina's Weibo service was the closest China came to a free flow of information.
It attracted celebrities, business people, political activists, dissidents, lawyers, ordinary people. It achieved much more mainstream popularity than Twitter ever did in the United States.
More than 60 million users sharing information about what mattered to them. It quickly became political, says China social media critic Jeremy Goldkorn.
Tweeting something controversial or critical of the government would lead people to repost it, and you'd get a popular bump by posting something that would attract eyeballs and that people would repost.
China's authoritarian government was not thrilled. It censored Weibo, going so far as to threaten users with prison time if they spread what the Communist Party considered rumors. And that's been bad for business. But as Sina prepares for Wall Street, Michael Clendenin of Red Tech Advisors says China's government is the least of its problems.
Weibo has been a race car which is being driven by amateurs.
And bad management, says Clendenin, has meant Weibo has lost customers to WeChat, a wildly popular instant messaging service hosted by the company Tencent.
If you look at Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, right, the big three internet companies in China, there's only one of those three that is in total attack mode on every front, and that is Tencent.
Clendenin says Sina Corporation should be able to raise $500 million for its IPO, but he says the company's slowdown and meager profits mean its Wall Street effort may prove to be too little, too late. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
If you go down a checklist of changes the Affordable Care Act brought to American health care, one of the things that's not really there is much about how doctors and hospitals get paid. There is a move afoot in Congress to fix that, legislation that would give them incentives to move away from what's called fee-for-service payments. But after running their practices and hospitals the same way for decades, how easy is it going to be to change the way they run their businesses? From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
When Dr. Kavita Patel walks into an exam room at the Johns Hopkins Clinic in Washington, D.C.,
¿cómo se siente? Un
poquito mal, me duele mucho. Esta parte de
sus
acá
pies?
Me duele mucho, sí.
¿Cuándo empezó?
She's got about 15 minutes with each patient.
I need to check to make sure you don't have a clot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what I'm worried about, you know.
The new ways that doctors are getting paid doesn't show up in these 15 minutes. It shows up after Patel walks out of the room.
So here's what I want to do. I'm going to have her call you in a week.
Across the hall, Patel instructs her assistant to follow up with the patient in a few days. And then there's another step. Patel herself will connect with the woman's other doctors. This is coordinated care, and it's more work. Work Patel doesn't do with her fee-for-service patients.
It's much easier for me to say, sorry, I can't help you. You need to make an appointment. It's much harder to do the opposite. It really is.
Many health policy people believe coordinated care is key to controlling costs. But here's the problem. Right now, almost all doctors and hospitals have an incentive to charge for everything from a surgery to the aspirin you're given after a surgery. Instead, the feds and private insurers want health providers to work within a budget, go over, eat some of the costs, come in under, keep some of the savings. Sounds good, maybe even better. But Dr. James Weinstein, CEO of Dartmouth Hitchcock Health Systems, says here's what people need to know.
Going away from fee-for-service fundamentally means less money.
That helps explain why doctors and hospitals talk about moving away from fee-for-service but aren't actually doing much moving. At Dartmouth, Weinstein is, as he looks to prepare for the not-too-distant future and trim expenses by some $400 million over the next several years, nearly a third of his budget. Less money, says Weinstein, means major changes to the business and to the people who make that business go.
Families rely on that health care facility for their jobs, for their pensions. The unintended consequences of this change has a human face that people don't see.
But even with less money, shifting payments away from fee-for-service contracts requires upfront spending to hire nurses, health coaches, and social workers to keep patients healthy. And then you have the tricky issue of what are called quality measures. To qualify for bonuses, health providers have to meet certain benchmarks, like lower readmission rates and patient satisfaction scores.
I don't think we've invested in developing meaningful measures.
Harvard Public Health Professor Ashish Jha says, right now, we're spending too much time on quality measures just because they can be measured, not because they're necessarily the right metrics.
If you have a patient who comes in with pneumonia, yes, you want to make sure that patient doesn't die, but one of the most important things is you want to make sure that patient can go back to work, that they can play with their families and lead a meaningful life. Well, how do you measure all that? You know, that takes work.
Jha and most other health policy people know moving away from fee-for-service, no matter how much it makes sense, isn't going to happen fast. But it will happen. In Washington, Dr. Patel says, as more healthcare providers experiment with new payment models, people start to see what becomes a nagging question.
If this is really the best thing to do, and we're only doing it for pieces of the population, what does that say about kind of the care we're providing to everyone else?
Patel says it probably means everybody ought to get that care. But in the next breath, she says, it's just really hard to do. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We started today with Bitcoin and Mt. Gox, which is, at its essence, all about online transactions gone very, very bad. But it's hard in the economy such as it exists right now not to be online in at least some form. That didn't stop Julia Angwin, though. She spent a year trying to avoid online surveillance, disconnecting from data brokers, encrypting her email, while still trying to have a normal economic life. She tells the tale in her new book. It's called Dragnet Nation. Julia, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
I want you to tell me about your husband and the energy monitors, please.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, let's start right in the domestic
disputes. Right to it. Yes.
Right. So I have been writing about privacy issues for several years and investigating them. And in the course of writing this book, I wanted to try to protect my privacy. But at the same time, my husband is an engineer and is really into putting sensors all over the house to try to make sure we're using our energy and water efficiently. And so he put all these things in the walls without telling me. And
Key point, right?
But anyway. Key point. Yeah. And I learned about it when some of his grad students asked me why our energy usage was spiking on Friday. So it was definitely an object lesson in two different people's approach to privacy.
You point out, as you work your way into this book, as readers work their way into this book, that what you're trying to find out is whether or not it's possible to live in this society, in the modern world, and evade what you call a dragnet nation, and you went in search of. Without spoiling the ending, how do you think it went?
Well, I had some successes, but I was not particularly successful at evading, you know, the vast suspicionless tracking that has become ubiquitous today. I managed to leave most Google services.
No mean feat, by the way.
Yeah, which right? wasn't easy. Yeah, I was very proud of myself. It wasn't easy to do. I used a burner phone, which I found actually not that helpful because it didn't have any of my information in it, so I didn't know
call. Because you've forgotten all the phone numbers, right?
Right. So it turns out that, you know, there are some things you actually do want with you, like your data. And then I set up a fake identity, which actually was one of my more successful experiments. Because I felt that there's no reason. There's a lot of people where I buy things with a credit card, but I don't actually really need them to know everything about me. So I have a credit card in a different name. And probably one of my more successful things was actually getting my kids interested in privacy. They started off not being interested.
Tell me about this thing you call the Hall of Mirrors. It's the very nugget of advertising and consumer data.
So the Hall of Mirrors is my word for what probably the industry calls personalization, which is that everything you see online in this mythical world of personalization will immediately reflect your tastes. When you go to a website, it'll perfectly have the news that you want to read. When you go to Amazon, they'll have the books that you want to read. And I don't particularly like the filtering because I feel that it actually limits my choices as opposed to expanding them.
Take me then to the conclusion of your book. You say, we didn't shut down the industrial economy to stop pollution. We simply asked the polluters to be more accountable for their actions. You want the same thing out of data collection companies and I would imagine the government as well.
Yes, I think that I want what everybody wants, which is I want all my cake and I want to eat it too, right? Yeah. So I basically want to keep my phone and I want to keep using all the fruits of the information economy. But I would like there to be some limits, right? I would like to have some assurance that if my data is used to harm me or if it's used to tag me so that I'm on the no-fly list because I looked at a jihad webpage, that I would have some rights to demand accountability, to fight that. And right now, there really is just no law that requires either the government or these private companies to be accountable for their data use.
It's a book called Dragnet Nation by Julia Angwin. She's a reporter at ProPublica. Julia, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which for the second day in a row, I learn a new word. Eructation is today's word. It's a fancy way of saying burp. Why, you ask, am I mentioning this? Because of the Environmental Protection Agency, thank you very much, which is out with a new report on methane gas emissions in this country. The biggest source, you may or may not be surprised to find out, is not the natural gas drilling business, but rather the cattle industry. I'll let you think about that one for a second. And in the meanwhile, you should know that it's not the end of the cow that's to blame that you may think. Hence, eructation. Bovine eructation, to be precise. And my day is now officially made. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow off about 27 points, a 10%. The NASDAQ down 5 points, also a 10%. The S&P 500 lost 2 points. That is less than a 10%. Nancy Fargali and John Ketchum are the producers on our Marketplace desks. Ariana Tobin and Raghu Manavalan are our digital producers. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll be back with more of the same tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.